Hello and welcome to the Stem Cell Report. I'm Martin Pera, the editor-in-chief of Stem Cell Reports, the open-access journal of the International Society for Stem Cell Research. In this monthly podcast, we look at highlights from the latest advances in stem cell research appearing in the journal. We will be speaking to authors to explore the questions that led to new breakthroughs and learn how they've tackled those questions. We'll hear about the background to novel findings, the challenges ahead, and we'll get to know a little bit about the personalities behind the work. Thank you for listening in. This episode is sponsored by Bio-Techne, and we'll hear more about them later on in the program. While advances in stem cell science have led to an increasing number of stem cell-based therapies entering clinical trials, the field is still relatively immature. Thus, these first-in-human trials are using pioneering approaches unique unto themselves. Scientists, physicians, and regulators are breaking new ground as they work together to assess the best strategies for moving a specific cell therapy for a particular disease into the clinic. In this episode of the podcast, we'll be speaking with academic clinician scientists who have and are leading stem cell-based trials to discuss some of the critical aspects of the process and reflect on the lessons learned during their translational journey. I'm joined today by physician scientist Dr. Roger Barker and Rajesh Rao. Roger Barker, a pioneer in developing cell therapies for Parkinson's disease, is a professor of clinical neuroscience at the University of Cambridge and consultant neurologist at the Addenbrooke's Hospital there. He is a principal investigator in the Medical Research Council Wellcome Trust Stem Cell Institute in Cambridge and director of the MRC-funded UK Regenerative Medicine Platform STEM and Engineered Cell Hub. Roger is a current ISSCR board member, the former chair of the ISSCR's Clinical Translation Committee, and a fellow of the Academy of Medical Sciences. Rajesh Rao is an ophthalmologist and the Leonard G. Miller Professor of Ophthalmology and Visual Sciences at the University of Michigan, director of the Retinal Service at the VA Ann Arbor Health System, and the Leslie H. and Abigail S. Wexner Emerging Scholar at the A. Alfred Taubman Medical Research Institute. Dr. Rao is currently running a cell replacement trial for macular degeneration and is the current chair of the ISSCR's Clinical Translation Committee. Drs. Barker and Rao, along with other members of the ISSCR's Clinical Translation Committee, have recently published a paper in Stem Cell Reports entitled Lessons Learned and Still to Learn in First-in-Human Stem Cell Trials. Welcome to you both, and thank you for being here.
Thanks for inviting us, Martin.
Thank you, Martin.
Roger and Rajesh, you're both practicing physicians who see patients on a regular basis. Roger is a neurologist. You specialize in treating patients with neurodegenerative disorders of the CNS, primarily Parkinson's and Huntington's disease. Rajesh is an ophthalmologist. You specialize in treating patients with retinal disorders, such as age-related macular degeneration and diabetic retinopathy. What drew each of you to medicine and to your respective fields? Roger, you could start us off.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question, Martin. I mean, I made a decision when I was about 15 to do medicine. And then the only other decision I've had to make in my life is what specialty. So where all these people are sort of worrying about what careers to follow, I've only really had to make fairly simple decisions. And I guess I chose medicine because I quite like science. I quite like solving problems, and I particularly like people. And I thought this would be quite a good combination of being able to help people solve problems and work in that sort of atmosphere and that sort of environment, really. And I ended up doing neurology. And there were lots of subjects I was quite interested. I was quite interested in tropical medicine at one point. And then I went to the tropics and got a tropical disease and decided, actually, that wasn't so much fun. I was quite tempted by intensive care, but I thought that was quite easy because everyone's plugged into machines and you don't really have much conversation with the patients in general. So and when I was an undergraduate, there's a chap called Tom Powell, who was one of the great neuroanatomists of the 20th century. And he made neuro seem so easy and so interesting. And he was very accessible. So I used to go and talk to him about various things. And I got very interested in neurology as a result of that, and particularly the basal ganglia. Because it seems like no one really knew what they did. And I thought this could be a great thing to try and understand. And from that, obviously, it led into my clinical interest in Parkinson's disease. So those were the early. So it was really Tom Powell back in the early 80s that got me going on it. And then there are various other people who persuaded me this was the right thing to do, including Andrew Lees and Steve Dunnett, who was my supervisor for my PhD. So that's how I did medicine, and that's how I ended up in urology, having flirted a little bit with other disciplines. I must say, I never thought I'd be an ophthalmologist because I thought that'd be super boring, staring into eyes, fiddling with people's eyes. But not something that appealed to me, but obviously I do the harder bit of eyes, which is the neurology of it.
Well, that's an interesting lead into urology.
But you know, Roger, we were told early in residency that the brain is simply an outpouching of the retina. So can I invite you to do a rotation with us here? So, you know, for me, you know, my mom is a physician, and then, you know, I was introduced a little earlier in life with that, but, you know, I probably didn't have the what really drove me apart from seeing one of my parents do it. And then I was a freshman at the University of Wisconsin in 97, 98. And I remember at that time, the big news on campus was, hey, there's a lab here, the primate center that has generated these cells, and they can make anything in the body. And you can study these cells at different stages that you could never get from, say, a postmortem sample or anything like that. And in a way, they live forever, but they're not cancer. And you could make things out of them that are useful in ways that Parkinson's or macular degeneration or whatever, in all these degenerative diseases, you know, the cells go away, and our human body doesn't have a real efficient way to fix things. So these were all those things in the late 90s sort of being marketed when Jamie Thompson had that paper in 98. I was 17 or so. And I thought as a freshman undergrad, that was the coolest thing. And that sort of gave me this purpose of why medicine? Well, here, if you could start treating diseases that couldn't otherwise be treated, this would be my kind of pathway into medicine and then learn more about science. And so I remember going to Jamie Thompson a little bit after, I think he appeared in Time magazine or something around that time. And I asked, you know, I was a freshman, and do you have any room? And he's like, oh, we're about to move our lab from this side, maybe from the primate center elsewhere or something. And, you know, maybe now's not a good time, but I have this colleague, Ian Duncan, who was in the veterinary school. Why don't you go and knock on his door? So I knocked on his door, and he said, sure, you know, why don't you come in? And this new postdoc, Su-Chun Zhang, who looks to have made some neuroepithelial cell types for the first time. And he knows Jamie well, and we're collaborating. And then that's how I got into it. And our goal at that time was, I was an undergrad doing like kind of pre-thesis project, something like that, and to how to make oligodendrocytes from at that time, some human neural cells, not embryonic, but a little later on. And then just amazing to see these neurosphere of cells that you plate, and that they were coming out, and these oligodendrocytes almost are like equidistant from each other, and they find that self-pattern arrangement. I remember another day with Su-Chun showing me things beating under the microscope, and might be commonplace now, but in the late 90s, you know, never seeing anything like popping out at you at the microscope. And I felt like, wow, this is really something. And we were reading a paper at that time, Ron McKay, about how to make oligodendrocytes. And I had graduated from Madison, University of Wisconsin, took a year off from the NIH, and worked with Richard Nakamura and Steve Hyman, who were at the National Institute of Mental Health. And around that time, there was talk about what is the NIH doing. I took kind of like a gap year, and got me more interested maybe on the science policy end of stem cells and unmet needs and diseases. And then I went after that to Yale Medical School, and kind of got involved in the, I started the stem cell interest group, which that was 2002. And we started from 5 people. And by the end of the year, it was like 150, 200 people of faculty and students interested. And it was really cool to see all these students interested. What is stem cells about? And we had, I remember at the end of that year, Christopher Reeve actually came, and he had a couple of years earlier, you know, had gotten in that accident, paralyzed from the neck down from the falling off a horse. And I think his daughter was at Yale at that time, and he offered to come and speak to our group. And got to introduce him. I was a big Superman fan when I was younger, and it just really got me on the kind of policy side. And then I was involved in the Connecticut Stem Cell Coalition in 2003, getting state funding for that. And then kind of worked with some faculty on the start of the Yale Stem Cell Institute. So ultimately, those are the key things that got me interested. I went and spent a year through the Howard Hughes and the NIH. They had a program where I finally got to work with Ron McKay. It was a paper I read when I was in Ian Duncan's lab, and spent a couple of years in his lab at the NIH stem cell unit, looking at mechanisms involved in neuronal versus oligodendrocyte differentiation. And that's what got me eventually hooked in on the science part. And I remember dissecting the kind of embryonic brain and mouse models, and was trying to think through the specialties. I think internal medicine, urology, neurology, neurosurgery, ophthalmology. And I really liked operating under the microscope. And I felt, you know, macular degeneration has this huge unmet need. I liked doing some of the dissection under the microscope. And that's how I decided ophthalmology, actually. And then when I got into my rotations, like, wow, you could see the optic nerve and the retina and the CNS using really basic instruments, you know, a light and a lens. And just went with it from there and got to this point. And it's really been fun, and really enjoy taking care of patients, both in the clinic and the operating room.
Terrific. Well, about the same time you were working on those neuroprogenitors with Sue Chun, I was down in Melbourne working with another clinician scientist, Ben Rubinoff, on the very
wow.
same time. Yeah. So guys, in addition to treating patients, you both run active basic research laboratories, and we're going to talk more about the unique role of physician scientists later on in the program, but how does your laboratory research integrate with your clinical interest, and, you know, how do you achieve what I might call a bench bedside balance? And Roger, I'll let you go first again.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite tricky, actually. I mean, my job is a 50-50 job, so I'm paid 50% by the NHS to deliver a clinical service and 50% by the university to do research. And of course, what that means in reality is the NHS want you 100% and the university want you for 100%. NHS wants you to see as many patients as possible, and the university want you to make them lots of money through grants and publish lots of papers. So they are a bit conflicting, really. And that is always a bit of a tension when you're trying to do this, because at the end of the day, the patient always wins over any research. So I guess the way I got into research was when I came to do my PhD 30 odd years ago. So Rajesh is a very young man. I mean, you know, 17 in 1998. I mean, I was ancient then. And so when I came to do research PhD in the early 90s, I wanted to work on brain repair, which at that point was really being explored in many different diseases. And I know we're going to talk about it a bit later on with respect to Parkinson's and the early trials. But at that stage, I was very interested about how we could repair the brain better. And then after having finished my PhD, I then had to go and train as a neurologist. So in the UK, it was much less integrated. So you qualify, you do 5 or 6 years of general medicine, then you do a PhD, then you do 4 years training as a neurologist. So by the time Rajesh was 17, I was about 104 and I was just starting my own lab. And actually, I decided that I wanted to better repair the brain in Parkinson's disease and other diseases of the basal ganglia. And I thought, in order to do that, I need to better understand the disease itself. And so I set about setting up a clinical research interest around better characterizing patients, better understanding patients, which then sort of feeds into your clinical interest. So I run clinical specialist clinics in Huntington's disease, in Parkinson's disease, bit of general neurology. But my clinical research interest, so I have half my research group work on clinical aspects of disease, which was to better define it, to work out which patients would optimally be treated by the cells which we would develop in the lab. Now, I'm not really a basic scientist. I work more on sort of applied science. But so questions I will ask, for example, in the lab are, if I'm making cells to put in people's brains, how much of an immune response will they generate? How immunogenic is that? Because that will have a direct implication on what we're going to do in our trials. I have the great good fortune have had the great good fortune to work with brilliant scientists. I've worked for a long time with the team in Lund of Marlin Palmer, Agnete Kirkeby, Anders Bjorklund. So I've worked very closely with them. And more recently, I've had great interaction with Johan Jakobsen there and Sarah Teichman and the Sanger Center and the whole developmental atlas. And so a lot of my basic research is helping others achieve what they need to achieve by providing reagents and a sort of broader picture. And I would think that's really what a clinician scientist is best equipped to do. I often say, you know, I'm not a very good clinician because I only spend half my time in it. I'm not a very good scientist because I spend half my time doing it. So what are you? A bit of jack of all trades. But actually, whilst that can be seen as a weakness, I think that's a strength, actually, because often you can see bigger pictures. And I think when we discuss the paper, it's that perspective which allows you to sort of look across the whole pipeline, if you like, the whole aspects of trying to do a clinical trial and understand the science and take it through, which gives you a unique position to see it from all aspects, whilst also being cognizant of what the patients and the public expect and are expecting and being realistic about that. So I would say it's difficult, but I very much try to steer my clinical research to set up the platform on which my basic research could work, whilst also being very open to collaborations with brilliant scientists who I feel I can merely help them achieve the great science they do and watch on in awe. But it's nice to be part of that journey and the work that they do.
Terrific. How about you, Rajesh? How do you manage both sides of your life?
Yeah, same kinds of struggles. You know, in our case, it's the same. I mean, the university wants you to bring in the grants and your department chair and all that, you know, wants you to see as many patients as possible. But, you know, they do feel here at Michigan, they do value the role of clinician scientists. But it's a hard balance. I think also, you know, I see patients, I do surgery, supervised surgery, and I also go to the VA hospital, you know, our federal hospital for veterans. And, you know, it's sort of just as Roger said, you know, it's a juggling and try to do your best. And I think one of the things is you try to also lean on the people in the lab, maybe more than you might have to if you didn't have clinical responsibilities, and trying to find good people, which seems to get harder and harder every year in the lab, but if people you trust and can kind of keep an eye on all the projects as well, in addition to you. And, you know, the focus of our, so in the clinic, you know, I see mostly diabetic retinopathy and age-related macular degeneration. I mean, these are huge numbers of patients in general afflicted by the disease, as they say. At least about the same number in this country, in the U.S., have some form, even early forms of age-related macular degeneration, as the total number of patients who have cancer, including skin cancer. So it's a huge population, most of whom are asymptomatic. It's not until it affects the macula do they come in. But ultimately, a lot of these are age-related diseases. And so, as someone who's at least since age 17 been involved in stem cell research or policy or something, I knew I wanted that to be a core part of my career, and I'm so happy it is now. And the question is, what is the best way for the stem cells in the lab to try to give you insights into the disease? And it's always been a struggle to think, how well can, say, stem cell or stem cell-derived organoids model the disease? Of course, if you're looking at the stem cell to generate the cell types that are lost in disease and then transplant, it's a very linear, very straightforward thing. But to be sort of on the production line of, okay, you're going to be the lab who generates the best looking cones ever in a GMP style thing, that takes tremendous amount of resources. And, you know, most junior, early mid-career like I am, you know, don't have that level of resources. So I've taken a lot of interest in modeling them. And even though I don't see those kinds of patients that frequently, I like to think that the stem cell, say, derived organoids, which is the focus of our lab, and kind of the epigenetic pathways, RNA methylation, histone methylation, methyltransferases, and how they regulate cell fate choice, probably tailors itself most to congenital diseases. And that's where I actually collaborate a lot with other clinicians in genetics clinics and in various countries in the world, thinking about what are the rare diseases that develop microophthalmia and for which we could potentially model at a much higher fidelity than trying to say, well, we can age them 60 years like age-related macular degeneration and then model them in the dish. And I think that's also something that is done. But I feel for me, the science is a lot fairer in a way that I'm making something embryonic and modeling an embryonic disease. So that's where the balance of that is. But of course, you know, there are things in diabetes and age-related disease, the questions that I have, and to some degree, they may not be as well modeled with the stem cell biology, but maybe on the surgical side, for example, an open question is in diabetic retinopathy, which affects, you know, the number one cause of vision loss in working age individuals, we really don't know what are the cells in the eye. And so from surgical samples, single cell RNA sequencing and things like that, we can make some insights into that. So I think it's a combination of where can I get through IRB or tissue or patient interest tissues to study the pathophysiology, and then try to use stem cells to model diseases, which I think they model. And then finally, when you have amazing collaborators like Sally Temple and Jeff Stern, you can finally be that last step in the clinical trial of, as a surgeon, to bring in those cells into patients with advanced atrophic neurodegenerative disease, which we're doing now. So it's a really exciting mix of the three, but it's a juggling act.
Well, you both are pretty good at that juggling. That's plain to see. Roger, you know, as Rajesh was pointing out to us, it's been 25 years now since Jamie Thompson first isolated and cultured human embryonic stem cells, and that launched a massive worldwide effort to learn how to control the cells and apply them in therapies for a range of intractable diseases. But a long time before that, the Parkinson's disease field was pioneering cell therapy, in fact, back in the 70s. Now, I know you've studied these trials in depth, and so the transplantation of embryonic midbrain tissue to treat Parkinson's disease was really, to me, a bold and innovative approach. But there were some mixed reports regarding its safety and efficacy, in part depending on which side of the Atlantic you were on. What were the lessons learned from those early studies?
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting, Martin. So, I mean, the original studies were done, I suppose, most famously by Anders Björklund. And actually, the project he was doing was to look at development. So the project was to look at the normal development of the dopamine system. And the best way to do that was, because you couldn't do them in culture, was to transplant them into a perfect organoid, which in fact is the brain. So the studies were actually set up to look at development. And it was only when people started using adrenal tissue, which is, you know, a little gland that sits next to the kidney, which produces very little dopamine, to try and repair Parkinson's, on the ground that you're going to replace the lost dopamine with another source of dopamine, that people said, actually, this is probably not a great source of adrenal. And that proved to be the case in the clinic. But actually replacing the lost dopamine cells, Parkinson's, with the developing dopamine cells, which normally appear in the midbrain during development, might be a sensible way forward. And so during the 1980s, early part of the 80s, towards the latter part of it, a lot of work was done to show that this worked. And when you think about it, it is extraordinary, because essentially what you do is you dissect out the midbrain from a dead fetus. So in the lab, that would be a rat or a mouse. You put it in the adult brain, and it not only survives, it turns into the dopamine cells, it makes fibers, it connects, it releases dopamine and helps the animal get back to normal. So the mere idea that this could work seems ridiculous, but actually it did. And so, as you say, this then led to early clinical trials, which were done mainly in Sweden, but with patients from other parts of the world, UK and Germany, and other places. So in Canada, Eva Mendes did it in Halifax, Nova Scotia, a Paris group did it. And there were lots of groups that did it. And it really, the success or not of that was a bit dependent on exactly how the trials were done, how they were executed, and partly coming back to what I said earlier about the selection of patients. So I think the most important lessons one learned from this was that there was not a lot of, the Swedish group were very systematic how they approached their trial, but a lot of groups rather didn't take such a systematic approach. And I think the subtleties, which is some of the lessons we've learned in how you do things, which seem at the time to be trivial, ultimately turn out to be major determinants. So, for example, when you're preparing the midbrain tissue, if you turn it into a fantastic single cell suspension under the microscope, or when you look at vital stains to look at live cells, it looks fantastic, but those cells ain't going to survive. And that simple procedure, which you would think is rather trivial and irrelevant, actually will determine the success of your clinical trial, because it will determine whether the cells survive. So what we learned from those early trials was, when it works very well. So the idea that you could transplant human fetal midbrain tissue into a Parkinson's brain, it would survive and not succumb to the disease process immediately, was a revelation at the time. And that it survived long term, released dopamine and put patients pretty much back to normal in the best cases, was a proof of principle. The problem was, as you say, it wasn't very consistent, and only a minority of patients, about a third of patients, had a significant improvement, two-thirds didn't, and some developed side effects, which were these involuntary movements, which you see in anyone who takes chronic L-DOPA therapy for their Parkinson's, but in this case, it came from the transplant. Of course, I can always get rid of L-DOPA-induced dyskinesias, because I can always stop L-DOPA which is the Sinemet Metoprolol in the UK, which people take. Obviously, if you have a graft-induced dyskinesia, I can't get the graft back, so you're in a bit of trouble. So studies in the States, NIH-funded studies in the 90s, which published in the early part of this century, showed that the transplants in their hands did not work and that they produced side effects. So I think the lessons we learned was that the results were very inconsistent, which meant it couldn't be a therapy for you know, prime time, because if you couldn't get a consistent response and you couldn't predict who was going to get it, how could you take that forward? There are clearly major ethical problems because you're using human fetal material, which comes from termination of pregnancies, abortion. So there are ethical problems. There were logistical problems because in order to have enough dopamine cells to survive, you needed the tissue from at least three fetuses per side of the brain. So you had to collect that over a short period of time. So there were So whilst it was clear that the results were that the tissue could produce a great result, it was inconsistent. It produced side effects. And so I think what we learned from that was this was not the way forward unless we could come up with a better way of predicting how people would do, which was where our clinical work came in about defining subtypes, whether we could standardize what we did in terms of preparing the tissue and implanting it, as well as the immunosuppression we gave afterwards, which was very variable. But ultimately, people at this stage were thinking we need another source of cells. So when the ESLs, human ESLs, were made by Jamie Thompson, obviously people started working around the idea, could we turn those into dopamine cells? When the iPS came along nearly 10 years later, people started working on that. So even, if you like, before those cells became a reality, people were looking for an alternative source. But we learned a lot from those trials. And, you know, we completed our own trial fairly recently using that approach. And then we're still learning from it. And I think a very important part, which is actually why we changed the title of our piece. We originally called it Lessons Learned in First in Human Stem Cell Trials, and we put "and still to learn," because I think the important thing is we're still learning as we do this, because there are many things we will never answer unless we go to the clinic. And that, I think, is where clinicians and scientists are so helpful, because they can give an informed view about the clinical problem, cognizant of the scientific issues or the scientific work which has led up to that translation.
Yeah, that's why I think it's incredibly important that these early trials, they may not produce cures, but we've got to learn what the problems are and learn what we need to address.
Yeah, because, I mean, if you look at Christian Barnard, I mean, everyone remembers Christian Barnard, first heart transplant. How long did the patient live? I think a couple of weeks. Did it make any difference to that patient? Not at all. But what we learned was it was technically possible to do it. So these, you know, what we learn with each one of these trials is terribly important.
Absolutely. So that story of the, you know, the fetal dopamine transplant will be known to some people. But Rajesh, maybe you could tell us about some of the early proof of principle experiments or concepts that suggested cell therapy could be a useful way to treat eye diseases and diseases of, you know, the macula, pigment epithelium, etc. That story may not be so well known to many of our listeners.
Yeah. It's an interesting question when you think about the CNS, because, you know, the neural retina, which is, you know, networked into other interneurons, ultimately getting to retinal ganglion cells, long axons to the optic nerve, a very long distance target to the brain. This is, I would say, a little bit more classical CNS type, where you have a very well-networked system. Interestingly, the neural retina sits on this kind of carpeted bed of retinal pigment epithelial cells, which, even though they're derived from neural progenitors, they themselves don't act as sort of sensory-like neurons like photoreceptors or interneurons or other parts of the CNS. And so they're thought to be the first insult in macular degeneration, the macula being the central part of your retina, which you use to see faces and read and all those things. So when you have atrophy of those cells, they don't regenerate properly. They actually do hypertrophy. They undergo division. They can migrate out of the retina. They can create scars. They can actually make bone, cartilage. And sometimes you see that in patients with trauma to the retina, where the RPE presumably is becoming very multipotent and making very weird things. So we know that it's a very interesting cell time, but it does not repair itself in a way to sort of restore that normal function in age-related macular degeneration. And because it doesn't necessarily have to connect the axon to dendrite in a similar way as maybe other neurons have to in the CNS, it's an attractive thought conceptually to be an attractive target. And so I think even early on, as people were first generating pluripotent cells in the dish, they were seeing various parts of their dish pigment. And ultimately, some of those things were turning out to be retinal pigment epithelium. And there have been changes from like 2D culture. And then early on with Yoshiki Sakata, it really made those retinal organoids in 2011, where you got really that nice morphology. But the benefit of pigment epithelium is that even before the organoids came out showing that 3D connection, you could make on a 2D surface the pigment epithelium and just carpet your dish with it. And, you know, there were indications early on in an RCS rat and some other animal models where they have MERTK mutations and they lost RPE. You could transplant these cells, and they some visual behavioral readouts, you could see that their vision was improving. And so I think around 2012, with ACT, that company, and generating retinal pigment epithelium from human embryonic stem cells, those started going into patients. And it really, I think, to start with maybe Stargardt's and maybe some small population of macular degeneration, also another form of macular degeneration called myopic degeneration over at UCLA and other sites. And that was, as far as I know, one of the first examples of embryonic stem cell-derived cells going into the human body. And, you know, a couple of years later, you could see evidence of pigmentation. And what I will say, over the last 10 plus years, there have been lots of efforts throughout the country and elsewhere in the UK as well, transplanting these cells. And I think one of the challenges is we're not yet seeing that home run per se, or even that effect of, you know, say too much dopamine in the system, these patients develop, you know, maybe particular side effects. We're not necessarily seeing that. And so in pigmented cells, the beautiful thing is you can look into the eye, and in the area of atrophy, it's either golden or white because you've lost those cells. When you're putting in pigmented cells over time, you think if they're engrafting, they're pigmenting. But sometimes the pigmentation is not always telling you they've successfully engrafted. You might be able to see leftover pigment or macrophages eating pigment, cells dying. So we're seeing some signals and various ways of squirting in suspensions or putting them on a kind of a membrane and injecting that underneath the retina. I would say there's some early indications that these approaches are safe. But I would say one of the challenges and maybe opportunities in our field is we don't yet see that, wow, that person has gone from 2200 to 2100, meaning their vision has really improved. And in some cases where patients have been able to maybe read, some of that may be side effects of the surgery itself. And sometimes hard to pinpoint, are they the cells or the surgery and the effect the surgery has on the underlying disease process. So I think it's been going on for 10 or 12 years. The animal models have been promising, but I think we have yet to see that real home run in the field that gets everyone excited, including the surgeons, the ophthalmologists, and the scientists, and of course the patients.
I think that's a very fair assessment. But maybe you could tell us about your current trial. I understand you're working with Sally Temple, a great colleague and a previous guest on the podcast. But the product there, in contrast to a lot of trials based on pluripotent stem cells, is derived from adult retinal pigment epithelium right. stem cells. So, you know, how does that compare with its counterpart derived from pluripotent cells?
We're very excited to be the site involved with Sally for the transplantation and also kind of first in human for this population. And, you know, I'm sure Sally and Jeff Stern would be the best experts at this. When I asked him that question I would say 6-7 years ago when we first met to talk about how would this trial look like, it seems from their data that there are some differences. They appear to perhaps in their animal models engraft a little better. Their visual function in these RCS rats seem to be a little bit better. Their transcriptome and some of these kind of molecular features may resemble the adult RPE more than those of embryonic stem cell or pluripotent stem cell derived RPE. So I would say it's a combination of you know, some of their transcriptomics data, their single cell data, and also their behavioral data, where they've tried to do head-to-head comparisons between their cell population, which is kind of an adult or postmodern derived population of adult stem cell derived RPE to the pluripotent stem cell derived RPE. And I think the concordance of studies they've done have shown that they get superior results with the adult RPE derived RPE.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. So Roger, you've been a part of multiple cell therapy trials and particularly consortia for Parkinson's disease, such as Transneuro, the one you mentioned that used the early progenitor cells, and more recently the GForce PD group using pluripotent cell-derived dopaminergic cells. So in these large networks, how do the groups from multiple institutions and trials work to share information? And I'd be curious to know, is the ultimate need for commercialization compatible with large-scale academic collaboration?
Good question. So, you're absolutely right, Martin. I mean, one of the lessons I guess we learned from the early fetal dopamine transplant trials, which I was discussing earlier, is that there was a lack of standardization. People tended to go on their own. Of course, it was a different world in those days, slightly harder to communicate in as we can in the 21st century. But there was a sort of sense that people weren't really joined up and sharing lessons learned so that we could all learn from each other and move forward in a more concerted way. And so when we came to set up Transeuro, which was the human fetal dopamine transplant trial that we've just finished, that gave us sort of an opportunity to bring together groups in Europe to think more about this. And then on the back of that, the ability to make embryonic stem cells into midbrain dopamine cells, which was done by Lorenz Studer's group in 2011 and Marlin Palmer's in 2012, meant that this was clearly the direction of travel. So it seemed very sensible that we should get together and learn as we go, both in terms of how we can turn those cells safely and consistently into the right dopamine precursors we need to transplant into people's brains, what we're using in order to define those, because obviously when we put these cells in, they're not mature dopamine cells, they're the precursors. So in pharmacology, it'd be like a prodrug. You know, you give something that gets converted into the active drug. Here, we're giving the precursor, which will turn into a dopamine cell, but that takes weeks and months. So how can we predict the product we're putting in will turn into what we wanted? So there were lots of questions we were asking ourselves. And as academic groups, we thought it would be very sensible to come together and at least share the problems we had as well as some of the solutions. Now, that was pretty innovative at the time. So GForce was pretty innovative. That came in, I think, 2013. I can't quite remember. All I know is that Cambridge United got our local football team got promoted into the Football League on the day we had our first meeting. So this was a tremendous day. but it was this realization that we could learn so much more together. And so over the years, that's been very helpful. And part of it is the fact that you have to have groups of people who are like-minded, because it only ever works if people are prepared to be honest and share the data, which is not published and may never get published because it's things that haven't necessarily worked. So there's an honesty, a transparency, and a desire to work together for a greater good. And that can work in some fields. It might not work in all fields. Now, the problem is, as you allude to, as these programs move towards clinical trials, they're obviously academically led. They get funding from agencies, such as national funding agencies or charities. But at some point, if you ever want your therapy to become a clinical reality, you are going to have to work with a company. And you can either set up your own company or you can work with an existing company. And I used to think that this was a bad thing to do. You know, academics stay in academia and they do their stuff. But actually, if you don't do that and you don't secure your IP and you don't secure, patents, you can do a successful trial, but there's no money in it. And if there's no money in it, there'll be no investment and you ultimately don't have a therapy. So you do the patients a massive disservice. Now, the problem is, of course, or the advantage when you start working with pharma is you have a reassurance, if you like, of how you're going to do it, because they have much more expertise in taking things to clinic. They also have more money to do this. But with that, there's obviously a reluctance to share all of the data in a way that was which was there when you were purely an academic group. So that has created a bit of not a tension, but I think to some extent we've gone to clinical trials. I think the next big step for us will be comparing our data from clinical trials. So the main groups who've been involved in this is Jun Takahashi in Japan. He's well advanced. You know, he started in 2018 with his. Lorenz Studer's and Vivian Tabar, they began their trial in 2021 and finished transplanting in 2022. There's other groups in America that haven't apart from Mass General, they've done one. So we're all, and we're about to start our trial very soon. So I think the next thing for us will be to compare clinical data, which I think will be less restricted, if you like, by the companies that we work with. But it is always an issue that we can't be as open as we can. But ultimately, the success of this field will depend on us working together to find the best solution. But the reality is that probably only one company will win, and that company will have the best therapy. And so obviously there will always be a bit of a reluctance. It's a bit like, you know, comparing a new anti-epileptic against other new anti-epileptics. No one wants to do it because they think theirs is better. But if you put one against the other and it loses, you can't come back from that. So there are some tensions there. But actually, I have to say, over the 10 years we've worked together, it's been a fantastically rewarding and inspiring group of people has worked to worked with. And actually, the field has moved forward much quicker as a result of that. I don't think we would be where we are today if we hadn't come together, scientists, clinicians, regulators, to work together. And I don't think pharma would have invested in it if we hadn't, in some ways, de-risked a lot of it by the work we'd done together.
Very interesting observation, and lessons learned brings me to your paper. So the clinical ISSCR Clinical Translation Committee, whose members include physician scientists like yourselves who are leading cell therapy trials across a range of indications, recently published this paper on collective lessons learned in their experience with first-in-human trials. I'd like you both to talk about some of the key lessons and just pick, both of you, a couple points that you thought were particularly important. Rajesh, you first.
Yeah, pleasure to work with the group on this. And, you know, one area I thought about was interesting was genomic integrity. And I say that partly also because we published a paper about a year before in Stem Cell Reports about risks patients may be willing to take when in the context of eye disease. And so, of course, the question of genomic integrity, you know, what is the starting point? What aberrations, if any, does your starting cell line have if you're going to be using it for therapy? How stable is the genome throughout the process? Say, if you're going to do genetic modification, such as generating an iPS line from primary somatic cells and then banking them, expanding them, differentiating them, it's clear that some cells can acquire mutations. And a typical way of testing, for example, by karyotyping and using karyotyping to look at changes in copy numbers and translocations, inversions, and things like that, may not capture the full diversity of alterations you may have. And I thought that was an interesting point that we probably are grappling with it in the field in general, and also trying to see what may be clinically relevant of those things. Of course, our intention is never to purposefully inject, P53 gain of function mutant, maybe along with some other passenger mutations into a patient. But one of the things to think about is how old are the patients who are getting this? And, we want the cell line as clean as possible, but, there's a lot of variants of unknown significance. You know, it's already quite an arduous process getting through the whole, ensuring the GMP quality and getting it all the way into the patient. To what degree do we need to be testing for everything? Is testing for everything super worthwhile when some of those things may not be clinically relevant? Are we adding for the sake of our best intentions about safety, but are we really introducing more difficulty in getting things from bench to bedside? And I mentioned our previous stem cell reports paper where we looked, at almost 200 patients in the clinics. And the bottom line is, the main fear and importance in genomic integrity is to, making sure whatever you're transplanting in doesn't develop into a tumor or worse, a metastatic tumor. What we found interesting is that when we query the patients ourselves, especially those who are maybe nearing the end of life, people with age-related macular degeneration, advanced versions, maybe 70, 80, 90 plus, and you ask them to sort of do a value comparison of risk, whether, the hypothetical risk, let's say, even if it far outweigh the true risk of a tumor versus, say, gradations and improvement in function, such as your ability to see 2100 or to read 2040, we were surprised, and this was related to age, the number of patients willing to take risk if they were to improve function. And so when I thought about this lessons learned paper and about this function, about this section about genomic integrity, there's, of course, what is the best way to capture all the variations? What about variants of unknown significance? What about hotspot mutations related to cancer? I mean, all those, I think, are well and good and challenges and opportunities. But I think being part of writing this section raised to me, what is it do patients care about? And that's why I really like stem cell reports, because it was something both willing to take in this perspective, but also a patient-centered perspective of what level of risk they're willing to take, especially vis-a-vis genomic integrity, as interpreted by, you know, risk of tumor or cancer, even if the risk is low. So that's what I enjoyed writing and being part of in this paper, and also thinking about some of the other work that's been in stem cell reports from a patient-centered view of risk.
Thanks. We're always really pleased to see those papers come in. So if you do any more work along those lines, send it along. How about you, Roger?
Well, I suppose there's two things which I always think about. I think one of them is the having the end in sight when you start. So I think if we take reduced example, I want to repair the retina, then I think it's very helpful to know, well, what am I actually trying to achieve here? What disease am I after? Who do I need to link up with? What do I understand the disease, and what is it I'm trying to achieve with my therapy? And I think, and I'm not saying that's essential, but I think it very much governs the line of work you do if you know what it is you're trying to treat. Whereas if I simply say, I'm just trying to make, I don't know, a retinal ganglion cell, you sort of think, well, that's terrifically exciting scientifically, but ultimately, what are you going to do with that? And what are you trying to treat? And if you're going to treat it, how are you going to get that in and such like? So I think having the end in sight for me is very important. So understanding the disease and what you're trying to do for the disease, and therefore the rationale of what you're trying to achieve. And that will come. That's an important point, because there's lots of stem cell therapies out there which don't have a clear rationale, and I think that can create problems. So I think having a rationale and understanding what you're going to treat. And I suppose the second lesson, I think, is don't underestimate the change from a research protocol to a GMP protocol. So a GMP protocol, for those that don't know, is obviously a good manufacturing practice. It's what you have to achieve in order to take something into the clinic, because it has to be of a certain grade. And the assumption that all the reagents are exactly the same as you use in the lab, but they just cost a bit more if you go for GMP, isn't the same, is not true. So this is a big problem, because it's a lot of work to change your protocol into something that's GMP-like or GMP compatible. And it's expensive. It's scientifically very boring, but it's essential. And if you don't do it, you can end up in trouble. So the assumption that you can just quickly change from one protocol to another by changing reagents and it will behave the same is, I think, underestimated. So those would be my two things. Think what you're trying to treat and design your program of research towards that. And don't underestimate when you flip from a research protocol to a GMP one.
Thanks, Roger. I often think I'd be a better scientist if I'd been exposed to the rigors of GMP early on in my career. But anyways, we're going to take a quick break. And when we return, we'll continue our discussion about lessons learned and to be learned from early stage trials.
At Biotechne, we want to ensure a consistent, safe and traceable supply of bioactive proteins for your cell therapy process. That's why we're rewarding listeners of the Stem Cell Report podcast with 20% off GMP proteins up to a maximum of $500 discount. Simply go to bio-techne.com/GMP-proteins to find your protein and contact us using the promo code 23ISSCRGMP to reap your reward.
Welcome back to the Stem Cell Report. We've been talking with Roger Barker and Rajesh Rao about the lessons they've learned running clinical trials for stem cell-based interventions. Roger and Rajesh, what do you each see as the biggest obstacle to overcome in delivering successful therapies, first for Parkinson's and then age-related macular degeneration? Roger.
So I suppose in Parkinson's disease, the current strategy is to replace the lost dopamine cells, which characterize these, by making a stem cell derived dopamine cell, which can replace it. So it's a very logical and rational approach. So I think that the challenges will be, the obstacles will be Can we do that consistently based on what I've said before? So you have to have a consistent response. And is it a big response? So, you know, the loss of dopamine pugs has been known since the early 1960s. And we have a lot of therapies that target that network, both in terms of drugs and neurosurgery. There's competing gene therapies. So the big obstacle, I think, will be proving that this therapy can be given safely, which I think it can be. But more than that, it can deliver an effective long-term benefit, which is greater than that which you can achieve with anything else in the clinic at the moment, which is also affordable. And I think cost will be an issue with this. Actually, the making of dopamine precursors is relatively cheap in terms of manufacturing. It's only a 16-day protocol, and you can make a lot of cells very quickly to treat a lot of patients. So in that sense, it shouldn't cost a lot in terms of the amount of energy and time you need to make it. But of course, I don't determine the price of these products. That's determined by the companies that own them. So I think showing that they're going to be competitive and showing that they're not going to they're going to be of a price which is affordable to healthcare systems around the world and not just a certain few. So I would say that as the obstacles currently for dopamine cell therapies. I think there are bigger problems in Parkinson's disease around other cell losses and other aspects of the disease. But for the moment, I would say that's what we're facing in terms of if we're to make our therapy competitive, those are the issues we have to solve.
Yeah, I think cost of goods and access to these new treatments is an issue just across the board in anything we do in cell therapy. Rajesh, you mentioned some of the kind of where we've got a bit with these trials for age-related macular degeneration and places where it's fallen short. What do you think the biggest challenge is there? What do we need to get to where we need?
Yeah. Well, maybe on the micro and macro end, and ultimately they affect the outcomes that we all want. You know, we always have this question about wiring into the system. You know, the pigment epithelium may be a more attractive target because truly it's not a neuron. But I think we need to really have evidence that the cells that we're putting in are not just pigmenting, but those areas of pigmentation are restoring function. And I think the kind of holy grail is, of course, hook into the photoreceptors themselves, the generation of cones in a high efficiency way and making sure that the cones are contacting the bipolar cells and the rest of the circuit. And I think where there are some limitations in understanding is when you have the diseased macula, some of this wiring goes awry and we don't quite understand how that is when versus the healthy retina. And are there some challenges and some opportunities? I don't know as yet if there's been any convincing data, both in the animal, but certainly not in trials where you can put a photoreceptor back in and show that donor photoreceptor is hooking in back into the system, especially in an environment that probably has some inflammation. And I think one of the challenges are understanding the degree to which inflammation is affecting the disease process and may affect the graft. And ultimately, where we want to see is an improvement in vision. And however we can do that, whether that means the cells are restoring lost function, or they're just simply factories that are producing cytokines to allow the host cells to survive, or maybe there's just something about the surgery itself, and it's not even so much the cells that can provide some stimulus to get the cells to either go back into the cell cycle. In the case of RPE, it's clear whenever you even tickle the RPE, as in a retinal detachment or injury, they tend to proliferate. If we could control that proliferation, perhaps we wouldn't need cells and a drug that's activating. But both, I think, at the micro and macro, the micro is hooking into the system, generating the cells, of course, in a cost-affordable way that are capable of hooking in to the visual system. And then, of course, what are the ways we're going to assess visual function and restoring that function? I think those are the two big barriers. It's hard to see objectively if we've done that yet, and what will we need to change in order to really, at the end of the day, make an improvement that patients notice?
Great points. I think, again, across the field, what happens when these cells we make are placed into a pathological environment? Do we get functional integration? Do we get secretion of factors? If they work, how are they working? I just don't think we know too much about that yet. So today we've been talking about cell therapies, and you know, physicians are obviously critical, not only in the testing and advancement of cell therapies, but also ultimately in their delivery to the patient population. So the Clinical Translation Committee of the ISSCR has amongst its directives a goal to help educate the broader community of physicians on the use and applications of stem cells. Now, Roger, I know this is something you've commented on before. So what do you see as some of the key issues here in terms of physician education, and how is your committee going about approaching this?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very good point. And you know, whilst it's physician education, it doesn't stop there, really. I think, you know, regulatory authorities, ethical boards all need help on this, because ultimately we're dealing with a new therapy here. So people have to understand that this is a treatment which is not a device and it's not a drug. Cell therapies are, you know, biological agents. And so it can be a bit hard to understand quite who's in charge of them. And obviously there's a lot of interest in this, and there's a lot of people who've worked on it, and some have greater scientific basis for use than others. So that, you know, as you know, there's a lot of stem cell tourism. There's a lot of companies trying to use stem cells to treat diseases. And I think one of the problems is that a lot of physicians who are very good at their clinical job will assume that when someone approaches them with a cell-based therapy for treating, let's just say, Parkinson's, given that's my area of expertise, that the appropriate work would have been done. The rationale is obvious. The preclinical data is there. And I think the problem is that often that's not there. There isn't really a very clear rationale. So often there's these things, coming back to the point you just made, we will give a stem cell therapy and it work bugs these because it will do something. We're not quite sure what, probably might turn into a dopamine cell, might secrete something, gets rid of inflammation, antioxidant. So it's a rather vague mechanism of action, which makes it rather hard to understand how it's going to work. And so I think what happens is that the physician thinks, well, this sounds exciting and I want to help my patient, so let's take this on. On the assumption that everything that has been done would have been done by the scientists to a level which you would expect if a big company came to you with a new drug. And that can be a misconception. So part of what we've tried to do is it's difficult because you don't want to be patronizing, and these are being done for the right reason. People are trying to help patients. That's a good thing to do. But we've tried to sort of give out guidelines and sort of help people ask questions of those bringing therapies to them, or to answer questions that patients bring to them about a therapy that they've heard. So I would every week get probably an email from someone wanting a cell therapy, which they've read about in a clinic somewhere around the world. And I will simply say, well, I don't know whether it works because I haven't seen any published data on it. That raises questions in its own right. But these are the type of questions I would ask of the company or the clinic or whatever that's offering that therapy. You know, what's the rationale? What's your preclinical evidence? Who's advised you on this? Which labs have you worked with? And such like. And I think it's to try and help people come to an informed decision as to whether the basis for what they want is being satisfied by the answers they've received. Because there are two things which I think confuse the issue. One is that people say, well, of course, we're not looking for efficacy. We're not looking to see whether it works in this trial. We're simply checking it's safe. Well, there's no point doing, I mean, obviously you need to make sure things are safe. That's obvious what you need to do. But there's no point doing it just to show it's safe. You're looking for some sign of efficacy. So you can't just sell it on the grounds that it's safe. And the other thing in quite a lot of diseases, especially brain diseases, is there's a sort of nihilism. You know, I've got motor neuron disease. I'm going to die of motor neuron disease, and I'm going to die in the next 2 or 3 years. Someone will say, try this cell therapy, it'll help you. And you think, what have I got to lose? I've got nothing to lose. I'm going to die anyway. And, you know, people will say to me, is there any chance it could work? And I'll say, well, there's always a chance. And they'll say, well, there's some chance against no chance, which is if I don't have it. So people slightly exploit the sort of sense of vulnerability of the patients and the sort of nihilism that the disease brings with it. So it's trying to get people to sort of get beneath the surface and try and ask the questions, so that they themselves are satisfied, either the patient, the public, or the physician, that this therapy is actually working in the way that it's supposed to do and will actually be of value in possibly helping this patient. I mean, a simple rule I always say is that there are no proven stem cell therapies for diseases of the brain. If you have to pay for it, there is a problem, because they should all be in trials and you shouldn't be paying for trials.
Sure. So you answered my question about some of the misconceptions. I'd just be curious, do you teach your medical students about cell therapy at Cambridge?
We don't tend. Well, it's a good question. I mean, I give undergraduate lectures, but that's more about brain repair. And I often talk to the medical students about treatments for Parkinson's, which has a little bit about cell therapies. But we do not We do not in general talk about it, in the terms that we've been discussing today. And what's quite interesting is even in the scientific world, I have two big beeps in the scientific world. One is the difference between symptoms and signs, which is not for us to discuss today. But, you know, symptoms are what people say and signs are what you find. So all mice are asymptomatic. So when people always write papers about symptomatic Parkinson's mice, you know, they can't be symptomatic unless they're talking. But anyway, that's another issue. But there's this idea that they cure. And obviously, some things do cure. So if you have bone, a hematological disease and you have a stem cell transplant, you will have a new bone marrow niche and you'll have new cells and you will essentially be cured. In Parkinson's disease, you know, however good your dopamine cell-based therapy is, it's not a cure. You're simply replacing a lost set of cells. The disease process will carry on in the background regardless. And that's true for a lot of stem cell therapies. They're very effective therapies and they may change the natural history of the treated disease, but they're not cures. And that, I think, is a big misconception because, you know, if you, Martin, have Parkinson's disease and I gave you a cell therapy and I said, this is a cure, you think that's it. I can pack up shop on that disease. It's all sorted, all done. I don't have to worry about it again. But you're not. You've just had a bit of your brain repaired. The disease is still there and the disease will still be active and other bits of your brain will be affected. And I think that's a misconception, not just amongst physicians, but I think actually with the public and, dare I say it, sometimes with scientists. I've even had a debate about can cell-based therapies for Parkinson's disease cure people with Parkinson's disease, and I lost the debate both before and after the discussion that everyone thought they could cure, and I think it's because people don't truly understand what the term cure means.
Well, certainly we basic scientists have a lot to learn from clinicians, and I think that that kind of brings us to an interest of yours, Rajesh. You and Roger are both physician scientists. And you in particular have written about the physician scientist, I think, is a bit of an endangered species, at least in your field. How do you think the ISSCR, the medical profession generally, can help attract and retain physicians that both practice medicine and run laboratories like yourselves?
Oh, that's a tough one. I mean, if you look at the proportion in the U.S. of MD or patient, those who see patients doing research is a significant portion, or at least looking at the NIH funding, you see that decreasing over time significantly. And, you know, I look at the ISSCR just as a microcosm of a clinical department these days. At a lot of universities and medical schools, a lot of translational and even basic science is done in clinical departments these days. Part of that in the U.S. might be because there's a backstop on the clinical side where, you know, at least at, say, the University of Michigan, a lot of the basic science departments are funded by an endowed fund. But interestingly, those departments are quite small. And a huge portion of the biomedical research, at least at our medical center, I think many, are being done in clinical departments because the clinical side can have a sort of a funds flow approach to maybe bridging some of the PhD scientists or the basic scientists in between grants, and also some of the physician scientists too, themselves. When I look at a department and I think about, okay, you have your grand rounds every morning, every Thursday or Wednesday, 7:30 a.m. And then you have the visiting vision science seminar speaker. That's at noon. And you're talking about two different groups of people who are showing up to their job, doing their job at totally different times. It may be hard for a scientist who may start their lab meeting at 9 or 8:30 or something to show up at 7 a.m. for a clinical grand round talk, even if a lot of the problems have a lot of relevance to what they're working on. It's sometimes like two shifts passing in the night. And I see that across departments and in different departments I've been in ophthalmology, and I'm sure it affects other departments too. And I always wonder, in an organization like ISSCR, and I remember being there when I was a medical student, I think the 2002, maybe the first meeting in Boston. And it felt to me at that time, even though I was in medical school, a very scientist-driven meeting. And I think in its infancy, as it should have been, you know, this is when things were getting attention and heating up based on advances in the lab. But now we're reaching the point where there are these first-in-human trials happening. There are a counterpart technology like gene therapy that are working in the clinic and in patients. How best to get those groups together? And thinking about ISSCR kind of at the vanguard of it, and so just thinking even about this meeting and talking with Jack Mosher and others, and thinking what are the really popular events for ISSCR at the meeting. And it seems, at least from what I've heard, that, you know, the kind of clinical translation or the how to do a first-in-human trial, or topics like that bring together both the expertise on the industry, entrepreneurial, the basic sciences, translational scientists. And I'm hoping over time, physicians themselves, those who see patients, whether they're surgeons or not, it doesn't really matter. But, you know, thinking, if what are the ways ISACR really attracts those groups of people? What are the real popular things that they have? And then maybe building off of that and off of that, you know, any clinician, I can say from the clinician end, going to a lot of clinician meetings, they love to also be ambassadors, even in an area they may not be so familiar with. And at the end of the day, surgeons and other physicians may be the site PI for a trial like, say, that Sally Temple is doing with us on our side, or in the UK, or Robin Ali, or these are people we interact with in our department. And I think making an inroad to physicians that way, hey, you know, this is one of the most popular events at this society, which is really the top stem cell society in the world. Can we bring in some of the one or two people and let them talk about maybe their experience as a surgeon, and then maybe have them network with the people who are really the regulars at the on the lab-based side or the clinical research side. I'm just trying to think of, there are some really great opportunities where maybe it might take an investment early on. Like maybe we'll offer free registration, or if they're a speaker, or travel. But to get to some of these, a lot of times they're notes. And in vision science, someone doing a cell therapy trial may be doing more than one. But 99% of the surgeons don't do any. So finding those nodes, where they are at, bringing them in, letting them get to know ISACR, and then building that network from there off a very popular event like the one the Clinical Translation Committee plans, maybe a pathway to really trying to integrate this perennial problem between scientists and clinicians.
Well, thanks. I can see why you're a good choice for the chair of that Clinical Translation Committee. One last question, Rajesh. You know, even up here in the Jackson Lab in Bar Harbor, the House of Mouse, we get young people who aspire to a clinical academic career. What advice would you give to today's medical students who are interested in a research career and maybe one day getting involved in developing cell therapies and running clinical trials, as both of you have done?
Martin, you're saying medical students, graduate students, both?
Doesn't matter.
Okay. One thing I see on the graduate student side, I have a few graduate students in my lab, and it seems more and more want to be translational. And I think there's some great unanswered questions using animal models, Drosophila, yeast, mice even, that have to be answered and are really building blocks of what the rest of us will do later on. But I am noticing, and that is my opinion and my biased perspective, that it seems more and more young people, even on the graduate student side, want to be, feel like they're having a hand or familiarity or foot in the door on the translational side. And I think that's probably not as much of an obstacle as thinking about the medical students. I think it's thinking about regenerative medicine, cell therapy, gene therapy. These are areas where I think naturally graduate students who want to be more clinically oriented may have an attraction to. On the medical student side, I think there's a lot of competing forces. I think when you're a physician scientist, especially one doing surgery, such as say retina surgery like I do, or a procedural thing like a gastroenterologist, the money that you can make when you're done with your training is so different. You can imagine in the US, the NIH funding and the cap, those haven't increased really for 20 years since the last period of doubling. And even an MD PhD student, super talented, goes into the field and they find at the end of training, they may have, maybe not MD PhD, but an MD student may have debt and they have a family. And, you know, they could be making 3x, 5x the money just seeing patients doing surgery. Why would you want to get involved in the business of writing NIH grants, recruiting graduate students, reviewing these things, a lot of which don't, for clinicians, don't, unless they're really passionate about the subject, lead to the remuneration. And I'm thinking about that maybe on the surgeon end. And I also think there, on the entrepreneurial side, Mark, there's a lot of interest for medical students. They want to think, what is it like to start a company? And when Roger mentioned, it isn't about it's an evil thing or something we shouldn't be doing by collaborating with industry. As we see in ISACR and all over, that industry is a really important component. And I think one way to hook today's medical students is to be okay about collaborations, investigator-initiated trials. How do things from the bench go to the bedside? I do think it comes from some industry involvement. And it's not just about a KOL or key opinion leader getting a lot of money to go to a meeting, talk about slides that they were given by industry. Maybe that's to some degree part of it, but to really start at the organic level of saying, you know, a lot of these talented students are thinking, maybe I'm sick of working at the hospital. I'm always employed. Maybe I want to start a practice. Maybe I want to go to industry and be an industry scientist. At the end of the day, they want to feel like they're, one, maybe in control, two, that they're making a larger impact more than just the patients they see and the life that they have to see patients in their clinic. And maybe that's where you introduce to them concepts like, hey, these ideas to make it to patients, the next generation of things really involve that co-ecosystem and being involved in maybe things like ISSCR, where they can network with all three groups of people. I think that's the way to get them into thinking about regenerative medicine, because I think on the entrepreneurial and on the translational side, it's really exciting. And I think for medical students, you have to approach them in a little bit different directions than graduate students. But I think there are those opportunities out there.
Thank you very much. That was a great answer. But I think looking at the two of you and colleagues like you, I've known physician scientists, the one point you made about having the passion to do it really, really explains pretty much everything. So that's all we have time for today. Thank you for joining. Thanks very much to our guests for sharing their stories with us today. And thank you to Bio-Techne for sponsoring this episode of the podcast. This has been the Stem Cell Report. Thank you again for listening.
The International Society for Stem Cell Research is a global scientific society that promotes excellence in stem cell science and applications to human health. Our vision is a world where stem cell science is encouraged, ethics are prioritized, and discovery improves understanding and advances human health. To join us, visit www.isscr.org/membership.